Hot garbage.
Hot garbage.
Hot garbage.
Hot pocket.
Welcome to Still Entitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Will.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Norm.
We're sitting in the wrong order.
Are we? Oh, you're usually over on that.
Usually on the outside.
I never remember.
It's okay.
It's okay for the audio. Don't worry about
it. It's okay. Can you tell I'm coming out of a different channel this time?
You're number two, which means I'm going to make
number
you a little
two.
Hotter.
You must say the number.
Prisoner?
Spyro from Brazil. The waiter.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Say the number.
You are leaving for tour tomorrow morning.
I am. It's true. The tour is happening. This is the first part of a two-part tour this year. This is happening now in April. Will take me all the way till April 30th. 17 cities in 19 days.
There's a lot of touring.
5 dates in Florida, a couple in Pennsylvania, a couple in Colorado, and some other ones salt and peppered around the country.
That's Colorado to Pennsylvania to
yeah, there's
Florida.
A couple,
it seems like a long spread.
There's a couple of jumps there.
Okay.
But, you know, it's touring life, and I'm it's a whole different reality, right? You get into the zone of touring, and it's a very different existence than the day-to-day, and the change is kind of nice.
Is this one of those things that you look forward to now? Like,
yes.
It's kind of a moment of zen in an otherwise hectic year?
It's not that it's a moment of zen, but it's a different creative exercise, and I really like the difference, and I enjoy the process. So, you know, on Mythbusters, on a day-to-day basis, we really do show up and make it up every day. Like, we have a rough idea what's going to happen tomorrow, but in the morning, that idea gets very concrete and may change radically from what we assumed the day before. And I love that challenge of, what do we say? What do we do? What's going to happen? How are we going to tell this story? And it involves a whole team. It's me, and it's Jamie, it's Steve, our director, and our production team. And that's, like, it's all-encompassing. You know, I can barely remember grocery lists while we're filming.
Well, and there's something... You know, Norm and I have worked in this in a similar world for a long time, where you work on something for a very short period of time, you get basically one shot to get it right.
Right.
And then after you get that one that's good enough, you walk away and you move on to the next thing.
And someone says the following week, hey, what did you do last week? And you're like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
I'll remember a year from now when it's on TV.
Right.
But you spend a lot of the tour, and you said creative differences because you're performing the same act that you're refining every night. But you also have a whole day of doing something different.
So the oscillation on the tour is that we're on a bus, and we're on a pair of buses, actually. There's a bus for Jamie and a bus for me. And those buses also sleep half of our team each. There's crew bunks and then a front lounge. And we, you know, go to a city. We'll arrive in Loveland, Colorado, perform from, I think, 7:30 to 9:30 p.m., have a meet and greet with some VIPs, get back on the bus by around 11, and we'll be on the road by 1 a.m. to the next day.
Wow.
So I wake up in another city, usually at like 8 a.m., go out, find some thrift mall. I loved finding antique malls. That's what I did the last tour. And then also come back to the bus and start thinking about that night's show. And you're right, Norman. The structure of the show is pretty similar every night, but I have been using the time to listen back to the previous night's performance and think about stories and transitions and jokes and pieces that I think could be better. And I concentrate on different parts of the show each night, and it's deeply satisfying. It's this wonderful opportunity to get an education in performance that normally only stand-up comedians really get, working over material and trying to find the place to make it natural, make it hit every time.
Well, and I have to imagine after years of, well, this one's good enough, let's move on, it has to be nice to be able to spend that time and spend a month refining one bit or two bits. Or
yeah,
three bits.
And, you know, the show gets better and better and better as we perform it, and I really dig that. When I come back, I often am like a little sad for a couple of days of like that
wistful
creative shift. Yeah.
So what are you doing in that downtime? I know a few years ago you brought a project to work on the bus.
I did, and that didn't really work out. I brought a project that was way too gargantuan for the amount of time I had, even on a 30-day tour.
One day you'll finish it.
One day I'll finish it. This time, I don't want to give too much away, but I am seriously toying with the idea of doing something other than writing about each city that I'm in, and documenting them in another, perhaps more novel way or ways.
VR. Virtual Adam, virtual tour.
Yes, you just get to live with me in my face all day long.
Strap Periscope. On
that's enough, right?
I'm going to Google Glass hole the entire country.
Oh, nice. don't do that, Adam.
No, I won't. It's also interesting that I'm traveling almost solely to cities in which I don't know anybody.
Hmm.
So on the last tour this last fall, I was in a lot of places I had friends. So, and that was great. I saw Commander Hadfield and his family in Toronto. I saw several friends in Pennsylvania. I saw, is someone knocking at the door?
No, no, did you point at the Mercury suit when you said Commander Hadfield?
No.
Oh,
okay. I didn't.
You did a gesture.
I like, did a,
what is it over there that represents Commander Hadfield? But okay.
And I came through Chicago, where I have a ton of really close friends. And I love, I'm actually going to Chicago. Well, actually, when this airs, I'll have already gone to Chicago. But I'm going to Chicago very soon, tomorrow in fact.
Chicago's great.
Tomorrow in the past.
I had never been to Chicago until earlier this year, like to visit.
Dude, Chicago
is amazing.
Chicago's a real thing.
It quickly became, within a period of hours, it became my probably second favorite American city.
So I'm going to say, when I lived in New York, I lived in Manhattan and Brooklyn for 6 years. I would regularly go to the Empire State Building about once a year. Because if you haven't been to the Observation Deck of the Empire State Building, it's a shocking and amazing experience. It's one of the great tourist destinations in the world, and I love it. Out here in San Francisco, I've been to Alcatraz 3 times, and Alcatraz is one of those, if you're coming to San Francisco, go do Alcatraz.
Even if you hate tourist stuff.
Yes. Alcatraz is amazing. They've got an incredible tour. They've opened up more of the island and of the buildings than they ever have before. And it's totally worth going to. In Chicago, they have a boat tour, a Chicago boat tour of the architecture of Chicago, like going through the river.
Oh.
And
the river that goes the wrong way?
It's the river.
South.
There's a 99% Invisible episode about the river because they changed the direction of it.
Oh,
because of, I think, sewage problems.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know
that. In the late 1800s or early 1900s, it was a big civil engineering project.
Wow. So you can take a boat up the river, and you can get an architectural tour of Chicago. And I will tell you, I did this. Julia and I did this a few years ago with our friends Kim and Clark, and it was fantastic. It was totally amazing.
I love
architecture.
It's one of the great architecture cities.
It is.
Truly is.
And as opposed to San Francisco, where we just have the generic skyline.
A weird mishmash. So I've had bad experiences on boat tours before. When I was a kid on family vacation.
Well, that's all you needed to say.
Right, we went on the family line.
Oh, in New York?
The circle line around Manhattan.
Yeah, no, my family has a story about that too. The 3-hour vomit tour of New York.
It was an amazing 35 minutes until you get north of, say, the East Village. Once you pass the United Nations building, basically it's all over.
Right.
You're just like, oh, well, okay, we got 4 hours.
Somebody's now we've got to go all around the north side of the island.
Yeah, oh, God.
Oh, yeah.
It's a long ride.
It is a long ride. My family had that, too. No, the Chicago boat is very staid and very calm.
Okay.
And just lovely. I have a ton of pictures from that vacation. But anyway, wait, where was I?
I gave you a family segue.
Oh, you did? Wow, nice. Thank you.
I mean, I don't usually tee those up.
I wanted to talk about families and parents. My mom was just here, and my mom's amazing. She's 80.
We've talked to her. She's great.
Yeah. Wow, that is. I think they can hear that on the microphone.
I might have it cranked up a little. I might have it a lot over here.
Right. We've had my mom on the talking room and the pod. She's been on the podcast too.
No, it's talking room, conversation. Yeah.
And she's phenomenal. And when she comes to visit, there's lots to confront. And what I mean by that is, it's fascinating. The older I get, how my relationship with my mom changes. And also the perspective I have on it changes. And that also informs the perspective I have on me as a parent with my kids. And it's just, I learned so much from my parents. And there are also things I wish I had been told when I was a kid. Not like giant things, just, contextual things. Like at one point my dad said to me, and I was a kid who idolized his dad. I completely, it was hagiography all the way with me and my pop. And that wasn't necessarily the healthiest relationship, but it was there. That's how that went.
There's two ways that from my experience, there are two common ways that relationship with your dad goes. One is that either you absolutely love your dad, and I love my dad. I give him a ton of grief, but I love him to death.
Yeah.
And the other is that you just kind of are like, well, you're kind of an asshole, sir. We're going to move on. And,
right. And
then you distance yourself.
Totally not the case, right? I totally idolized him. I wanted to be exactly like him. And he died in 99 when I was 32. And I missed the hell out of him. He would have gotten a great kick out of what's happened to me over these years.
Yeah, because that was pre-Mythbusters.
Yeah. I had just started Industrial Light and Magic about a month before he died, and he was deep into dementia at that point. So there's no recognition of that. But where was I going with this? Oh, at some point, I think I was about 17, and he said offhandedly, all parents disappoint their children. And I thought, well, when is that ever going to happen? No way. You're crazy talking. And lo, later on, when the scales sort of fall from your eyes in your 20s and you see your parents as more human than you ever had seen them before through the lens of being more of an adult, that phrase he gave me context with which to kind of handle that experience. And that was really, really valuable. And so I think about that kind of thing a lot when I think about talking to my kids about the stuff that's coming up now, because they're 16, they're ascendant, they're smarter than me, faster than me, stronger than me now. And I, at the same time, I'm feeling pretty good about myself. I mean, I feel like I'm in good shape and good place in my career and all of that. And yet to my kids, I'm old, man. And
there's an arc of how the children and their parents have the relationship.
The younger generation's right. Coming up.
Well, there's a reverence, yeah. And then there's a feeling of competition. And,
there's the whole Oedipal thing,
and then it loops back to it.
Well, and there's a couple. I just noticed this a couple years ago because I have a relatively new kid. There's a couple of big transitions. There's the moving out of the house transition.
Yeah.
Where before that probably there's the rebellion tradition where the parents are the people who are keeping you down. That's probably where you're at right now. Or maybe not like
hardcore. Or with the kids.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're dicks. Yeah. We ground them. At this point, there's not a lot of teaching that we could do to them. It's more like just pushing them out into the world as much as possible. Go get summer jobs. They're getting summer jobs this summer. They're going to work their asses off. Awesome. And it's going to suck and be awesome all at the same time. We are all formed in the fire of early jobs, yeah. Right? We talked about that.
Yeah, there was nothing better than 17-year-old me who came off from literally the worst lunch shift waiting tables I've ever seen, and then leaving work at 3 o'clock and going to the lake and spending the $5 that I made on a 12-pack of beer and sitting at the lake and drinking a $5 12-pack. And this, that is an earned feeling.
Right, right, right. That's hilarious.
Kind of. Still pissed about that place. Oh yeah, he'll work for free. He'll just work for tips, my father said.
Oh my god.
Now the relationship that your kids have with you, is it akin to the relationship that you have with your dad, being an artist and someone of note?
It's hard to know. It's really hard to know from inside this, I want them to see me as human as humanly possible. I want them to see that I work hard for this, that it is luck and circumstance, and it's not necessarily permanent, not at all permanent. It's actually all totally impermanent. And so this is also the only reality they've grown up with.
Mm-hmm.
And that all of that is like, what can you do? You can just try and be as honest as possible. I mean, before you have kids, you have all these ideas about how you'll raise kids. And then once you have kids, there's just the day-to-day grind. And occasionally you check in on an overall philosophy about raising kids. But for the most part, it feels like we're just taking this every day.
I was a lot older than you when I started having kids, though.
This is true.
Like, we had the benefit of having watched all of our friends have kids, or many of our friends have kids.
Yeah, yeah.
And we could kind of go back and look at the ones that turned out okay and the ones that turned out to be little nightmares.
Wow. Yeah.
Kind of pull the ones that turned out okay.
Oh, man.
All other dads are future Wills.
I once heard of a couple who got into a routine with their baby, that the baby had trouble going to sleep. And the method they came up with, and you have to be careful about your coping mechanisms for baby sleeping. The method yielded a situation where they had a 4 or 5 year old child that the father had to lie down with for 90 minutes every single night to get them to sleep.
Nope. Just shut the door and let them cry for a few minutes. They go right to sleep. It's all fine.
Oh, dude, you have to. It's that is the point to me where it's like training a dog. You accept the behavior you're willing to accept. You're willing to deal with, and you don't. You have to compare it against the reality you're willing to live.
Deep-seated trauma for life.
So one of the things
nobody escapes trauma. Nobody escapes. You are going to traumatize your kid no matter what. You have to realize that just being human is traumatic in and of itself, and there is no ideal. There is only what you can do. Mm.
It's pretty grim.
No, I don't think that that's grim at all. Actually, I think that that's liberating.
Well, the fact that... Fair enough. Being human is traumatizing.
Yes, being human is traumatizing. This is Buddha's first truth, for Christ's sake.
And when they realize...
Buddha's first truth, for Christ's sake. I think Christ would have agreed.
It's
all suffering, right? And this is just, really, nobody escapes. And so having twins is actually a great way to throw nature versus nurture right out the window, because they grew up under identical circumstances and they could not be more different people.
So do you... One of the things that I've tried to avoid doing, because the temptation is really strong, is to experiment on my kid. Because I know my parents did it to me, right?
Really?
Like, I mean, not like legitimate in a constructed, intentional way.
Abu Ghraib kind of way? Is that what
you're saying? Yeah, the early waterboardings were rough as a 2-year-old.
The great tiger mom experiment of Tennessee.
Yeah, but I mean, they would... You kind of can't help it, right? Like you're sitting there and you're like, oh, I got to get my kid to go to sleep. How am I going to, let's try it this way this night. Let's try it this way tomorrow night. And, you know, if we never communicate that most kids don't like Brussels sprouts, is she going to like Brussels sprouts? Turns out she loves Brussels sprouts.
One of my kids' favorite vegetables as well.
Yeah. If you don't give the context that this is a challenge, this is a thing that might be challenging to get you to eat, then they never pick up on that until it's too late.
You know, it's Mike Birbiglia has a terrific joke that begins with the line, you know when you drop a baby? And it continues. And he looks up at you and he doesn't realize how bad what's happened has just, he doesn't realize how bad the thing that's just happened is until he sees the look on your face. And then begins to freak out.
Yeah.
Right. And the other day, there's this local couple who are sort of friend acquaintances of ours, and their kid, we were at a party and their kid fell down. And it's one of those moments where the kid goes boom, boom, and everyone in the crowd goes
shit
and looks.
Stops,
and the kid's looking up, and the mom just calmly walks over and she looks down. And she goes, how you doing? And the kid's like, okay.
Yeah.
And I was like, that is awesome.
Wow.
That is how you do that.
I okay, Dad.
Made of rubber.
Yeah, man. You just got to realize, like, they are going to take their cue from you, and you can, you can experiment with different modes of eliciting different behaviors.
One of the things that I think about a lot is the stuff that I wish that my parents had told me that I had to figure out the hard way. And some of it I think you have to figure out the hard way.
Of course.
But
when there's a whole, you can try and think around that, but there'll be a whole set of stuff that they'll grow up with and be like, I wish you told me that.
Yeah, and it's...
But like, what kind of stuff do you come up with?
It's things like, you know, your girlfriend when you're 17 years old, you're going to feel emotions you've never felt before at a strength of which you've never felt emotions before.
Yeah.
And that is going to make your judgment bad, and you don't want to, don't get so tied up in the moment that you forget about living the way that you should be living then.
And in fact, actually, that's an area in which a few years ago we started to give them a lot of contextual advice about the ways in which, you know, if you are around somebody and you feel shitty all the time, that's not okay. Whether it's your best friend or it's a girlfriend or it's a group of kids you hang out with, you have the right not to feel crappy. And frankly, I would love for someone to have told me that. We didn't kind of have that cultural language in the 70s as much as we do now. We understand. I really feel like that. I mean, I could be completely off base.
No, I just assume that that's the way life.
You know,
life's tough.
If I went to my father and talked to him about like kids at school, that I didn't like to spend time with. You're like, well, you know, you're always going to have to spend time with people that you don't like.
Which is totally true.
Yeah, but...
But at the same time, to be able to self-actualize, to realize I don't need to endure this. I can actually change this reality, which is a very powerful thing. And it's a difficult thing for a kid to learn.
It's a difficult thing for anyone to learn.
It's totally true. And, you know, the closer you get to that. So I've had one boy break up with his girlfriend and get back together with her. But when he broke up with her, the ways in which he talked about it made me feel so good about the strength of his heart and his mind at that age. I mean, it's private for him, so I don't want to talk about it too much, but he used phrases that showed his genuine kindness and self-actualization of like, this is important that this be like this and feel healthy and not feel this other way that shouldn't feel. And I, you know, something needs to change. Like, I've never come to that conclusion at 16 years old, and I gave him tons of props for that. It just made me feel so good about his mental health moving forward.
Yeah, my move when I was 17 years old was just to be such a spectacular asshole that eventually she'd dump me.
I mean, no, I totally, it's
avoid
all
the problem.
That's what's so great about the allegory of Buffy the Vampire Slayer is it. When you're that age, it feels like life and death. Joss Whedon's brilliance was to make it actually life and death. That the moment you sleep with the guy, he becomes an actual monster.
I never watched Buffy.
Oh, dude, you have to see. Buffy is...
It's on the Gene and Will watch list.
I know. Go see The Wire. Watch The Sopranos. Blah, blah, blah. Buffy the Vampire Slayer, one of the most important cultural institutions I can think of. I love that show. Deeply, deeply, passionately love that show. When the Jenny Calendar episode, it's one of the saddest things that I've ever seen on television. And those of you Buffy fans out there, you know what I'm talking about.
Okay. What do you wish you had learned from what do you wish your parents had told you? I mean, part of this falls into the category of things that you're never going to kind of figure out yourself. But like, look, what are the things
I don't know that my parents could have pierced the loneliness that I felt when I was a kid. But that is definitely a prevailing feeling I had and I grew up with. I don't think that was their fault. I think it's a dint of all sorts of things. Public
school. You have siblings.
I have five siblings, but there are three different litters, three different marriages. Okay. It's a whole Brady Bunch. It's more complicated than the Brady Bunch by a fair bit. But, you know, I was a very lonely kid, and I think a lot about the decisions I made in that loneliness and talk to my kids sort of through that lens of saying, you know, if there's a situation in which you're making too many decisions because you think no one is around to help, that can generate a feedback loop that doesn't serve you as an adult. One of the family mottos that we had, which was actually the best, one of the greatest things my parents gave me was, well, let's see. The story goes that my father was a big time commercial director in New York in the early 60s, a real madman and a creative. And he partnered up with an amazing guy, a producer named Harold Friedman, to form the Savage Friedman Consortium. And they worked with everybody. And Harold, when they put the partnership together, said, Lee, we're going to form this partnership. We're going to generate a lot of buzz about you. We're going to get interviews with you in the trades. And there's going to be a whole bunch of stuff going on. And if you start to believe in your own bullshit, I'm going to cut you loose.
So this is basically like season four of Mad Men.
It is. And don't believe your own bullshit. Realize that the things you use to do your job and to go through your life are, some of them are constructs, a lot of them are bullshit, and people will perceive them how they perceive them, and that's not something you can control, but don't drink your own Kool-Aid.
Phenomenally good advice.
Such good advice. Yeah. And I really try and inculcate my kids with that, of like, this isn't real. This is lucky. We get to fly to London like this because we're going on a press junket. That is great, but it is rare, and you will fly coach until you can afford otherwise.
Right.
But
there's usefulness
to
it.
That's real.
You can separate it, but there's a reason and a purpose for that bullshit.
Yes.
It's not that you don't want to have it.
No.
But you separate that from your core being.
You totally do. You realize that there are gradations on all of these mm-hmm. things. So that was probably one of the great family mottos one could grow up with, especially given what's happened to me over the past 20 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's especially apt.
It is especially apt. How about you? Norm, you haven't talked about this.
I don't think I just I think in terms of what I wish my parents told me, probably why they made their decisions, I don't think that I would, looking back, I wouldn't want them to change the decisions, even though at the time probably resented that. But then, like, those decisions were important to make me who I am.
Yeah.
By understanding the reasons.
You mean like the things that they made you do?
Exactly.
This is one of those things, right? There's like, when you look at your life, if you're happy with it, that's the result of everything that's happened to you.
Yeah. It reaches the point where if you get to a point where you would not take the time machine, then you're at a good place in your life.
Exactly. The corollary to that is John Kabat-Zinn says, you want to know how your life's going to turn out? You spend a lot of time thinking about it. How's my life going to turn out? You want to know how it's going to turn out? Look around. This is it. It's happened.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's like super, again, one of those things that through one lens, it's kind of dark, but through another lens, it's super empowering and super liberating.
I think this is way more on the empowering side.
I totally agree.
I mean, one of the things that my dad actually did tell me is that I asked him if he regretted anything when I was leaving for college, or maybe when I graduated college, I can't remember, but I was early 20s, late teens. And he said, look, I try to live in a way that I don't have regrets.
Yeah.
And when I make decisions that are hard or scary or bad, then I have generally tried to make the one that I'm going to feel like I took my chance and I did the best that I could. And if that's not good enough, then so be it. But, you know, I took the chance.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty healthy way to live, it turns out.
Totally agree. I totally agree. And yet you can't escape the things that you regret that happened. And I mean, it still lingers, and you have to realize that, you know, you do your best. There is no perfect. There is no ideal. Again, I go back to that. There's no ideal way to parent. There's just, you know, trying to have an honest relationship with this being and give them the tools to go out and be smarter than you, hopefully.
It got deep.
That got deep. Shit got deep.
I mean, but that's the goal, right? When you have kids, you want them to be better than you were.
That's, I just read this line of Louis C.K. is like, if you feel dumb around your kids, you're doing a great job.
Yeah.
That is how that stuff works.
Louis C.K. is really the great sage of our time. And on that note, I think
that's a reasonable place to leave it. I'm heading out on tour. We have some podcasts built up.
I think we have enough buffer to get through the tour.
All right.
Maybe a couple week after you get back. So you
and
can
we'll start some new ways of communicating my tour travels on the site.
Cool. Can't wait.
We will be back with another episode of Still Entitled from the can next week.
From the can.
We're going to talk about watches.
Wait, we recorded a whole one in the bathroom?
We can. I mean, the seat's up.
The echo chamber. We're going to call it Welcome to the Echo Chamber.
Echo, 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 echo. See you guys next week. Have a good tour, Adam.
Thank you, sir.
See you.
Bye, guys.
Bye.